Let's go ahead and get back into Moses' second law, that is the book of Deuteronomy. It is a final address that he's making to the Israelis in the 11th month of the 40th year of the Exodus. The way I keep describing it is he is the teacher who realizes that he has to graduate this class on to its next phase without him being there. He's going to die and not go into the promised land with them. And so he is cramming every bit of review he can into their hearts and minds before he lets them go. And so the book of Deuteronomy has an awful lot of repeated material. Some of it is expanded information. Some of it is fairly new because it's not recorded in other parts of Moses' writings. Now, where we're looking at right now, chapter number 16 of the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is going back over the calendar situation. The Israelis have a six-year cycle of work followed by a sabbatical year. Then we come to the idea that each year there are certain mandatory feasts, mandatory festivals, holy days, that the Israelis have to participate in. Now, the ones that he zeroes in on are those that require coming to the central worship site. Any adult Israeli, male in particular, that is in good health is supposed to come to the central worship site. We'd call it the tabernacle at the time we're studying right now. Later, it will be the temple. But they are to come to this centralized worship site to offer sacrifices as part of this celebration, this commemoration of some event in Israeli history. So we started out, first of all, in the first month of the year. That's in the springtime. Usually last part of March, early part of April is the kickoff to this first month of the Jewish holy year. And it starts with Passover on the 14th. That's when they butcher the Passover lamb. And then it's followed up with the 7 days of unleavened bread, days which commemorate that first week of travel where they did not stay in any one place long enough to let bread rise before they baked it. So the first day of unleavened bread is the 15th, and that is a day off. It is a non-work day. The last day of unleavened bread is the 21st, and that also is a day off of normal work. That week is going to always contain a first day of the week, no matter how it falls on the calendar, no matter how it falls on the cycle. There's always going to be a first day of week that falls between the 15th through the 21st. That first day is going to be the beginning of the count toward the next holiday that we take up today in Deuteronomy 16:9. And this is what it says. You shall count 7 weeks. That's going to be 49 days. Begin to count the 7 weeks from the time the sickle is first put to the standing grain. Now that's tied in with the week of unleavened bread. So you've got the first day of the week during the week of unleavened bread, the dates 15th through the 21st. That first day is going to be the day that the high priest and his entourage go out into the barley fields, because that's the grain that is ripening at this time of year. And he's going to cut himself a representative sheaf out of that field of barley. He will bring it before the Lord's presence, wave it in front of the Lord's presence, and that is what is referred to as the first fruits offering. Now, symbolically, that is Jesus. Jesus is the first fruits of those resurrected from the dead permanently. And so what does he do? He resurrects on the first day of the week during Passover week. And the way that it worked in the year of our Lord's atonement was that he, of course, had his Passover meal with his entourage, his disciples, on the night of the 14th, as the sun went down on that Friday night. On that Thursday night. Then the following day was still the 14th, because that's the way the Jewish calendar system works. And so everybody is getting their Passover lambs ready to be butchered for the next night, if that was their custom. Because all that said was that this Passover lamb had to be butchered between the evenings. So sometime between sunset that started the 14th and sunset that began the 15th. That's when the Passover lambs were butchered. Jesus and his apostles, being Galileans, apparently did their meal one day sooner, one evening sooner, than the Jewish people living down in Jerusalem. Because Jesus ends up dying as the Passover lamb on the 14th, on Friday. And then he's buried before sunset, and that kicks off then the 15th day of the first month. That was a Sabbath that year. And then he was in the grave all that day. And then on the 16th, he resurrected from the dead on the first day of the week and became the first fruits offering. So hopefully that all makes good sense on how this program worked in the year of Jesus' atonement. So the Jewish people always started their count on a first day of the week during the Feast of Unleavened Bread and went 49 days into the future, plus one more day, which would make it 50. That's why this is called Pentecost. That's a 50 count. And so that brings us back to a first day of the week again. And so verse 10 of Deuteronomy 16 is a reference to Pentecost, that first day of the week celebration that happened 50 days after the first fruits offering by the high priest out of the barley fields. Verse 10, "Then you shall keep the feast of weeks to he who is your God with the tribute of the freewill offering from your hand, which you shall give as he who is your God blesses you. And you shall rejoice before he who is your God, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite who's within your towns, the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow who is among you, at the place that he who is your God will choose to make his name dwell there. You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe these statutes." So Moses says, make sure that 50 days after the Feast of First Fruits, you have the Feast of Pentecost, and it's going to involve food again. It's going to involve an offering again to the Lord at the place that he decides is the central worship site. And when you're eating that sacrificial meal, when you're eating this celebratory meal, make sure that you invite your neighbors, your friends, your relatives, your local Levites and priests and all of those people that maybe don't have a family of their own, like the widows and the orphans and the person who's visiting from out of country. You invite them to your meal so that they can join you in celebrating God's blessing on your life. And so that is the Feast of First Fruits, followed up by the Feast of Pentecost. And then there's only one other mandatory feast that falls in the fall. And that's what we call the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths. The Israelis call it Sukkot, which is just the Hebrew idea of these lean-tos that they put up. Verse 13, "You shall keep the Feast of Booths 7 days when you've gathered in the produce from your threshing floor and your wine press." Because it comes in the fall, September going into October, this is when you bring your tithe as an Israeli to the central location for worship, because the tithe is owed to God and you give it to his workers, to the Levites and the priests. And you always get to celebrate that first week of meals using part of your tithe, but the balance of it goes into the storehouses of the Levites and the priests. And we kind of studied once before that in the six-year cycle, the years 1 and 2 and 4 and 5, that's the years that you took your tithe to the central location and left it there. In the years 3 and 6, you would keep your tithe locally because you have local Levites and local priests living near you that are going to need those supplies for their service and for their life. Now, verse 14, we get back to the Feast of Tabernacles. You shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the sojourner, the father, the widow, who are within your towns. So you're supposed to, again, make sure everybody has a chance to celebrate the blessings of God upon the nation of Israel by being part of this happy celebration of Feast of Tabernacles. And that includes a lot of eating, a lot of enjoyment of each other's company. Verse 15, for 7 days you shall keep the feast of He who is your God at the place that He who is will choose, because He who is your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful. And the Feast of Tabernacles was the 15th through the 22nd of the seventh month. And so you started out with a day off on the first day, and then 8 days later, you finished it up with another day off from normal work before everybody headed back home to get ready for the next year's agricultural cycle. Verse 16, a little reminder here. 3 times a year, all your males shall appear before He who is your God at the place He will choose, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Booths. As I've said before, all adult men who are physically capable of doing so are expected to go to the central worship site for these 3 festivals every single year. Verse 16 continues, they shall not appear before He who is empty-handed. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of He who is your God that He has given you. So everybody brings something to offer as a sacrifice to God. And it was anticipated that these 3 mandatory feasts, Passover and Unleavened Bread, Pentecost, and Feast of Tabernacles, were supposed to be very happy times, wonderful times of community celebration. Now we need to change your topic again. Verse number 18, Moses says, you shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns that He who is your God is giving you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. So the Israelis are going to need some sort of legal system that is local, so that things can be taken care of at the lowest possible level. And this is really good design. And it's the sort of thing that all countries should utilize. Once you put those judges and other support personnel in place, you should remind them that they are there to keep things fair. Verse 19. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, and you shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. So you're not supposed to look at the person and their relationship with you and decide the case. You're supposed to decide the case on its merits. You're not supposed to accept bribe money in order to judge in favor of the person with the most cash, because that is not fair either. everything is supposed to be done with complete, total fairness, equity, according to God's standard. And that still remains to be the case to this day. Any of us as Christians that might find ourselves in the legal system, we're supposed to look at every case independently and see them for the merits of that case alone. We're supposed to be fair. And that has some practical things that maybe some people don't appreciate. And that is, if you have somebody come before you that was convicted of robbery once before, you can't just automatically assume they're guilty of the charge of robbery that's happening this time. That would not be fair. You have to look at the case as an individual circumstance and see whether or not this person did it, because they might not have. And then you also, this comes from another place in the writings of Moses, you can't feel pity for the person, and even though they're guilty, let them off because you feel pity for them and rule in their favor and against the plaintiff just because they're poor. You have to decide every case based on the merits of that specific case, because that's the only way to be truly fair. Verse 20, justice and only justice you shall follow, that you may live and inherit the land that he who is your God is giving you. And that is most certainly some principles that we need to apply to our own way of dealing with legal issues in our own country and in our own time period. Now we have another change of topic, because Moses is just going through all sorts of things that are on his heart that he wants to reinforce with his students before they go into the promised land later. Verse 21 of Deuteronomy 16, you shall not plant any tree as an Asherah beside the altar of he who is your God that you shall make. And you shall not set up a pillar which he who is your God hates. Now what's being described here is idol worship. Asherah was the female goddess of fertility. She was the queen of heaven of the Canaanites. She was the feminine divine. And the way that she was usually represented was by a tree, possibly a living tree, but also it's possible it might be some sort of totem pole. And so the Israelis were told, don't you dare plant or place some sort of worship device for Asherah or Ishtar next to God's worship site, because he's the only one you should be worshiping. The pillar, the stone pillar that's described here, is a representation of the feminine, of the masculine deity of the Canaanites, of the Middle Eastern people, Baal, the thunder and lightning god, the rain and storm god. And so God, the Father, the real God, the true and living God, the Creator, says, you will not put anything from the worship of the Canaanite gods and goddesses anywhere near my worship site. You keep it away. Now, unfortunately, the Israelis did not pay attention to that. And we will find out if the Lord gives us the opportunity in our fifth time through Scripture, that one of the things that happens toward the tail end of Judah's history is that they put an Asherah pole right in the temple complex near the shrine building. And this happens during the time of Ezekiel, shortly before God causes the temple to be destroyed. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 1. Change of topic again. You shall not sacrifice to he who is your God an ox or a sheep in which is a blemish, any defect whatsoever, for this is an abomination to he who is your God. This is an insult to offer to God substandard sacrifice animals. And it's actually one of the things mentioned in the book of Malachi, where God's complaint is, how dare you, when you have a decent sacrificial animal in your flock or in your herd, how dare you bring me something that's on its last leg, something that's almost dead, or something that is diseased or sick? Would you try to give that to your governor as some sort of payment? Well, I am the great God. Why are you trying to give it to me? And so this is one of the things where we take as a principle that when we give things to God, we need to give him our best. We give him our best efforts. And if we are actually going to donate physical things, we ought to give good things. I almost always bring up at this point the sad situation that people too often get in the habit of whenever they're renovating around their house and they've got some old cast-off furniture that they don't want anymore, and instead of giving it to the dump where it probably belongs, they donate it to the youth program. And I've been in many youth rooms where there were broken down couches and rocking chairs and things of that nature. And it's just shocking that people think that that's a good idea, to give their junk to the Lord's work. Not a good idea. Verse number 2. If there is found among you within any of your towns that he who is your God is giving you, a man or woman who does what is evil in the sight of he who is your God, in transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, or the sun, or the moon, or any of the host of heaven which I have forbidden, and it is told you, and you hear of it, then you shall inquire diligently, and if it is true and certain that such an abomination has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has done this evil thing, and you shall stone that man or woman to death with stones. We've seen this before. To worship other gods and goddesses in the nation of Israel, within the framework of the Promised Land, that was an insult to the true and living God who gave the Israelis that land. In fact, it was rebellion. It was treason. And it carried with it a capital offense. They were to be executed. And so Moses is just going over that right now. Is if you actually have somebody that worships other gods and goddesses inside the boundaries of the Promised Land, they are to be stoned to death. Verse 6, on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. Good judicial standard, you have to have multiple independent testimonies about a crime in order to find the person guilty. And in this case, since it's a capital crime, the Israelis were supposed to clearly have multiple witnesses of this paganism, of this worship of other gods and goddesses. And then the hand of the witnesses shall be put first against him to put him to death, and then afterwards the hand of all the people, and so you shall purge the evil from your midst. Witnesses had to understand the gravity of their testimony so that they would not perjure themselves. And so they needed to understand, whoever it is that you say is guilty of this capital crime, you better know you're the first person that's throwing a stone. You're the first person that will participate in the execution of this guy or this gal. And so this was supposed to have a chilling effect upon false testimony. There are other ways that false testimony was controlled. one of my favorites, because I think it's a very useful one, is that if you get caught bearing false testimony, whatever the penalty was for the trial, should it come to a guilty verdict, that penalty is assessed to you as a false witness. So if you were involved here giving false testimony about a capital crime, if you were found guilty of bearing false witness, you were executed. And so these are just ways that the legal system of Israel was to keep people on the up and up, to keep people fair in how they carried out their legal lives. Verse 8, in any case, if any case arises requiring decision between one kind of homicide and another, one kind of legal right and another, or one kind of assault and another, any case within your towns that is too difficult for you, then you shall arise and go up to the place that he who is your God will judge. You shall come to the Levitical priests and to the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall consult them, and they shall declare to you the decision. Then you shall do according to what they declare to you from the place that he who is will choose, and you shall be careful to do according to all that they direct you, according to the instructions that they give you, and according to the decision which they pronounce to you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the verdict that they declare to you, either to the right hand or the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not obeying the priest who stands to minister there before he who is your God or the judge, that man shall die, and so you shall purge the evil from Israel. So basically, you have a high court. There were these different levels of judicial proceedings, but eventually it could come up to the high priest and to whoever the government leader was in that day, and they would go to God and get a rendering of judgment. And that was an absolute, this is the way it must be. Verse 13, and all the people shall hear and fear and not act presumptuously again.